If you're black and you can't pay your light bill because you don't make a living wage, or you're white and you can't pay your light bill because you don't make a living wage, we're all black in the dark. And the only way to get in the light is for all of those in the dark to exercise their power. We're in the final one, a critical moral moment, because 90 million people, with all of this authoritarianism and neo-fascism being spewed and put in policy through this current administration, 90 million people stayed home. The current Congress is made up the way it is because of only 7,000 votes. And in many states, the margin of victory is within 5% of just the number of poor, low-wage people that didn't vote. And they said they didn't vote because nobody talked to them. Jesse would talk to them. And we need to be doing it today.
Bishop William Barber, we want to thank you so much for being with us. President and Senior Lecturer of Repairers of the Breach, Founding Director of the Yale Center for Public Theology and Public Policy. Coming up, an update on the U.S.-Iran talks in Geneva as the U.S. expands its military presence in the Middle East. Stay with us.
پوتین رو گلوم تناب دور گردنم جدتر که روی پام ولی با ظرف میزنم زخم بازم و مکم فشار بده تو خسته میشی و من جا نمیزنم زانوم روی خاک مرگم مسلمه این شعر آخری تنها سلاح همه بازم ازم بگی خاکم رو خونم و حتی جنازمم حرفش رو می
A new song by Grammy-winning singer Shervin Hajipour, I'm Iran. He dedicated it to the protesters killed in Iran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to news from the latest round of talks between the U.S. and Iranian officials, which took place in Geneva, Switzerland, Tuesday, against a backdrop of heightened saber-rattling between the two nations. President Trump's order to build up of U.S. forces in the region, including two aircraft carriers, dozens of warships, hundreds of fighter jets, and multiple air defense systems. On Friday, President Trump told reporters regime change in Iran would, quote, be the best thing that could happen, unquote. Shortly after the talks began, Iran temporarily closed the Strait of Hormuz, a key international waterway. And Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned, quote, the strongest army in the world might sometimes receive such a slap that it cannot get back on its feet. Unquote. After Tuesday's talks, Tehran's foreign minister cautioned more work still needs to be done on reaching a nuclear deal, but expressed some optimism about the negotiations.
I can say that in this round, there were quite serious discussions and a more constructive atmosphere than in the previous round. Various ideas were raised, and these ideas were seriously discussed, and finally we were able to reach a general agreement on a series of guiding principles. From now on, we will move based on those principles and enter into the text of a possible agreement.
Three unnamed Iranian officials told the New York Times Iran had indicated an openness to suspend nuclear enrichment for 3 to 5 years in exchange for lifting sanctions and the embargo on its oil sales. Vice President J.D. Vance, speaking on Fox News, painted a more mixed picture of the talks.
I think the president has a lot of options. We do have a very powerful military. The president's shown a willingness to use it. He also has a remarkable diplomatic team. He's shown a willingness to use that, too. And so what the president has been very clear with the Iranians, and actually I just talked to Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner this morning about some of their negotiations, is the United States has certain red lines. Our primary interest here is we don't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon.
For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita Parsi, talk about what's happening in Geneva, the U.S. moving in aircraft carriers, one the largest in the world, the USS Gerald Ford, which he had just previously, Trump had, off the coast of Venezuela, where they attacked Venezuela and then abducted the president, Maduro, and his wife.
You have a very dangerous situation because both sides actually believe that a short, intense war may improve their negotiating position. The Trump administration, of course, believes that because of its overwhelming military power that it has now gathered in the vicinity of Iran, it will be able to take out Iran militarily rather quickly and then force it to capitulate. The Iranians have a different calculation. They believe that they have the ability to inflict significant damage on the United States in the short term, including on civilian oil installations in the region, closing down the Strait of Hormuz that would shoot up oil prices. And the initial cost of this to the United States would be so immense. And the United States would recognize that it would have to go for a longer war, which it cannot afford. And as a result, it would get the United States to back off. Essentially, the Iranians are counting on the U.S. having a much lower threshold for pain tolerance than what the Iranians have. And they're basing this partly on how the Houthis fought back against the U.S. for several weeks, and eventually Trump essentially lost interest in it and did not want to have a prolonged conflict and backed off. The difference, however, is the Houthis never managed to kill an American soldier. They tried, but they didn't manage. And we have not been in a situation in which 30, 50, perhaps 200 American soldiers are killed under Donald Trump's watch. So we do not know how his psychology will react to that type of scenario. So this is an extremely dangerous situation in which both sides are actually incentivized to escalate with calculations that are completely contradictory to each other's.
And Trita, what is your sense of if hostilities do resume again and the U.S. attacks, the impact on the wider region, the potential, let's say, worst case scenario for the region?
Well, the region, by and large, with the exception of Israel and perhaps the Emirates, are completely against this for a variety of reasons. And they've played a very crucial role in trying to de-escalate the situation and find a diplomatic solution. The talks in Geneva, for instance, were hosted by the Omani foreign minister at their embassy. You have several factors here. On the one hand, of course, these countries are very worried about the instability. They do not believe that there will be some sort of a clean regime change in Iran, but rather that it will be a state collapse, potentially civil war, massive amounts of refugees flowing into other countries in the region, secessionist movements on the borders that will take advantage of the situation, a scenario that would be very problematic for Pakistan with the Baluchis, for Iraq with the Kurds, for the Turks with the Kurds and with the Azeris. And as a result, they really stepped in. Now, one thing that is very important to understand is that these factors were present in the past as well. And in the past, some of these countries were favorable towards a military confrontation, such as Saudi Arabia. They've changed their minds, not just because of these consequences, but because of a deeper geopolitical change that has occurred in the region. Right now, Iran is much weakened, and Israel has become much stronger and completely unrestrained. The United States, since the time of the Biden administration, has essentially lifted all constraints on Israel. Israel is allowed to not only violate international law, but also violate American law. And then the government's or the administration of the Biden team, as well as the Trump team, have essentially violated American law by lying on behalf of Israel in Congress. At least the Biden administration did this. This has now created a situation in which many of these countries in the region have now realized that their alliance with the United States does not protect them against Israel. Israel has attacked seven countries in the region since October 7th, including Qatar, who has some of the best air defense systems that the United States has put there. But apparently those American air defense systems were not activated when the Israelis attacked. So if an alliance with Israel, with the United States, cannot help balance against Israel, then these countries have concluded that they need to create their own arrangement to be able to balance against what they see, an increasingly aggressive Israel that is seeking regional hegemony. Iran is not part of that constellation, but it is a de facto buffer between these countries. And this is Turkey, this is Saudi Arabia, this is Qatar, this is Pakistan, perhaps Egypt. It's a buffer between them and Israel. And as a result, they have this added reason to want to prevent this war because they need that buffer. Otherwise, they believe they will be the targets, the next targets of the Israeli state.
And I'm wondering, there's been a lot of media attention in the U.S. and in Europe, interviews with the Iran's exiled crown prince, Reza Pahlavi. I'm wondering your sense of why so much fixation on this almost a relic of past institutions in Iran.
Well, the son of the former Shah has emerged as a voice that some people in the diaspora have surrounded, have, you know, lent their support to. He clearly has a tremendous amount of support from Israel. He has closely allied himself with the Israelis. He supported the Israeli war in June. He is calling for military intervention, either by Israel or the United States in this case. And what we have seen over the course of the last two decades is a dramatic radicalization of the population as a result of both the brutality, the repression of the Iranian regime, in which it has refused to meet the demands of society. By and large, there's been a couple of exceptions, but in reality, Iran is more closed, more repressive today than it was 20 years ago. And on the other hand, policies driven by the United States and the West, as well as supported by people like Reza Pahlavi, that have sought to sanction the Iranian economy to oblivion, to destroy much of its resources and wealth, and as a result, impoverish the population and drive them to a point of desperation in which they now have become so desperate, not all, of course, but a portion of them, a very loud portion, have become so desperate that they are even yearning for their country to be bombed as a way of getting rid of the current government there. And this is a dramatic development, mindful of the fact that Iran is right next to Afghanistan, right next to Syria and Iraq, and have seen what these military interventions have produced in these countries, which is absolute disasters. But the combination of the repression of the theocracy and the manner in which the sanctions have destroyed the livelihood of ordinary Iranians have driven them to this point of desperation, in which some, again, not a majority, but a loud number of people are now calling for this. And Reza Pahlavi has become the main channel for the demand for military intervention.
And we just have 30 seconds, but Patrita Parsi, we've talked to so many allies of the protesters who are anti-regime in Iran, but also anti-intervention.
Absolutely. I would still say that there is a majority that are completely against intervention, but their voices are more or less not being heard in the mainstream media. And I think this is very much because of the support of certain elements to elevate the voices for intervention. And we're seeing exactly what we saw during the Iraq war, in which a large number of pro-intervention Iraqi voices were paraded through mainstream media in order to give the impression that not only is this something that is supported by the overwhelming majority of the Iraqi society, but also that this is the morally right thing to do. And I find that to be very, very questionable.
Trita Parsi, I want to thank you for being with us. Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Coming up, we speak to Alexis Goldstein. She was just fired from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We'll also speak to New Jersey congressional candidate, labor activist Analilia Mejia. Stay with us. Legendary pianist and composer Randy Weston. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to look at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, the agency the Trump administration has been trying to dismantle for over a year. Last week, it fired program manager Alexis Goldstein for documenting a meeting a year ago between the agency and Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. That's according to emails obtained by Bloomberg News. For more, we're joined now from Washington, D.C. by Alexis Goldstein, longtime financial regulatory expert who once worked on Wall Street before becoming involved with the Occupy Wall Street movement. Alexis, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain exactly what happened a year ago with these DOGE temporary workers coming into your agency?
So on February 7th of 2025, we had just seen the dismantling of USAID. A wrecking ball was taken to that agency, and it became clear that the second agency that was going to be attacked by this administration was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So I came in like I normally do. I drop off my toddler at daycare. There isn't stroller parking, so I wheel in my stroller, my empty stroller, to the CFPB headquarters in Washington, D.C., and I was wheeling my stroller around the basement, and I noticed a number of people who I had never seen before who were not wearing the required CFPB badges, and they were accessing what appeared to be CFPB equipment. So I wanted to take a closer look. I wanted to try and investigate. We are told over and over again that we are supposed to report suspicious activities, that we are supposed to defend the sensitive data that we hold of American people. Millions of people trust us with their vulnerable moments if they're scammed by their financial company, if they're having trouble with their mortgage. The technical term we use for it is personally identifying information, and we have a lot of very specific training about how to handle it. And so I was very concerned that the people that I had never seen before were there, appeared to have CFPB equipment. So I tried to take a look. They moved from one conference room to the other when they saw me into a conference room that didn't have a window. And so I decided to go into that conference room. I ran into a coworker of mine. I asked him if there were DOGE folks in the room. He declined to answer. So I opened the door and introduced myself. And I said, "Hi, are you my new coworker? What's your name? Can I show you around? We have a nice rooftop." And there were three individuals in the room. One I now know to be Jordan Wick. He immediately ran away out of the room. The second was Jeremy Lewin, who was a big part of dismantling USAID. He immediately went into the corner of the room. And then the third DOGE individual was Christopher Young. I didn't know any of this at the time. I just asked them what their name was. They refused to give me their name. They said that they were authorized to be there, but they didn't have to tell me their name. And I said, "We have a lot of really sensitive information and data from Americans. We have personally identifying information. Do you know the trainings that we have to take in order to handle this? Have you had those trainings? Do you know what those trainings are?" And they just stared at me blankly and said that they wished that security would come and kick me out of the building. A couple minutes passed where I continued to try to ask them their name. They refused to answer. A security guard did come down, asked me to leave the room. I immediately left the room. I presented my CFPB badge, which I had. These individuals did not have CFPB badges. And I asked the security guard, "Who are these individuals? Are they authorized to be here? What are they doing? I see they appear to have a CFPB laptop." And the security guard didn't know what to do, so he just turned away from me and got on the phone. And so I eventually walked away. I left of my own accord. And then later that day, I got an email saying I was immediately being placed on administrative leave and I was not to enter our headquarters in Washington, D.C., nor access any work systems. And I have been on admin leave ever since until I was fired last week.
And Alexis, your termination is the latest escalation between staff at CFPB and the Trump administration. How has the agency been effectively dismantled, as you see it?
So the CFPB doesn't cost the public a single dollar, but has returned $21 billion to consumers in its short lifespan in the form of relief and restitution. I think that made us a big target. We do a lot of good. We don't cost the public a single dollar. So one of the first things that happened actually later that day was Elon Musk tweeted RIP CFPB. An email went out over the weekend saying that everyone, not just me, but everyone was banned from going to our headquarters building. We were ordered to stop all work. And then they began slowly over the coming weeks to dismiss our lawsuits, over 20 lawsuits against financial firms, including firms like Navy Federal, who had already agreed to a settlement to give $80 million back to consumers. That money never went back to consumers. And these lawsuits were dismissed with prejudice, which means that we can never bring up those lawsuits again. The supervisor, so I, as Amy mentioned, I got my start on Wall Street before, during, and after the 2008 financial crisis. And part of the reason the CFPB was created by Congress is because Congress felt the other regulators fell down on the job, and there needed to be a single agency to protect people from predatory scams and discrimination in lending. And they created the CFPB for that reason. And so we regulate the nation's biggest banks. And we are normally, in normal times, we have supervisors who go and sit inside the nation's biggest banks. One of the first things the Trump administration did is sent all the supervisors home and told them to stop showing up to work. And so essentially no one is watching the biggest banks. There's no one trying to enforce the 18 different laws that the CFPB oversees.
So, Alexis,
and it's just been...
So, Alexis, yes. Then what are your plans now?
So I'm trying to turn lemons into lemonade, and I'm actually going, I'm running for the House of Representatives in Maryland's 6th District. It's a slightly crowded race. There's two mega millionaires that are already running in the Democratic primary, April McLean Delaney and David Trone. But I think that the people of the 6th District deserve someone who's going to fight to build libraries, not ICE jails, like the detention center they're trying to build in Hagerstown, Maryland, that's going to fight to fund schools, not data centers that are giveaways to big tech. And I think that the district has shown enormous bravery, the residents there, in standing up for their neighbors. And I think that Maryland 6 deserves a representative that shows the same amount of bravery as ordinary people. I'm not doing this as a vanity project. I'm doing this because I want to fight against fascism in America.
Well, longtime financial regulatory expert Alexis Goldstein fired last week from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, announcing now that she's running for Congress from Maryland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in New Jersey, where we're joined by Ana Lilia Mejia. Last week, she won the Democratic primary to fill the House seat left vacant by New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill. If Mejia wins the special election on April 16th, she'll become the first Latina to represent New Jersey's 11th district. Mejia is the daughter of a Colombian garment worker and a Dominican laborer. She's a longtime labor organizer who served as 2020 national political director for Bernie Sanders. She also served as deputy director of the Labor Department's Women's Bureau under President Joe Biden. This is Ana Lilia Mejia speaking at a Sanders rally last month.
Renee Good and Keith Porter and all the Americans and all the human beings who have suffered under this rising tyranny deserve justice. And I say, abolish ICE now!
In an unexpected twist, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, may have inadvertently helped Ana Lilia Mejia win last week, even though she described Israel's actions in Gaza as genocide. A super PAC linked to AIPAC spent at least $2.3 million targeting her opponent, former Congressman Tom Alinowski, who's described himself as pro-Israel, but also said he would be open to placing some conditions on U.S. aid to Israel. Ana Lilia Mejia joins us now. So you have two elections in front of you. You have the April 16th election for Congress, which you are favored to win. But then you have to go right into a primary again, because that election is the special election to fill now Governor Mikey Sherrill's seat when she was Congress member. And now you have to run for the seat that you might win. Is that right, Ana Lilia Mejia?
Yes.
And what are your plans?
Yes, and then I have to do it again in November. So by the time that I'm done, it will be
four races in, 9 months? But as an organizer, as someone that is deeply connected to community, I know that it's an opportunity to engage voters in New Jersey's 11th congressional district. I ran this primary thinking and acting like an organizer. So I knew that I had to both introduce myself to my potential future constituents, but I also made a point to run trainings in the district to engage people so that they understood not only had a better insight on how they could address and meet rising authoritarianism, but how to protect themselves from the rising violence of ICE that's happening across our country and starting to happen in New Jersey's 11th district as well.
And Ana Lilia, could you talk a little bit about how you managed to win despite being outspent by several of your opponents in this race?
So, you know, races are, we know the biggest problem that we have in our nation is the outsized power of big money. We know that big money floods our electoral system. It then shapes or takes precedent in our policymaking. And it is a serious problem, obviously exacerbated after the Citizens United decision. As organizers across the country understand, you know, it's either people power or money power. And in this instance, what we focused on was how to connect with people, how to engage across the district and talk about the outsized power that big money has. So by the time that AIPAC is making its big money spend, we had spent some serious time talking to voters about how that kind of action would end up corrupting our political system, our policymaking system. And I think it worked. It is, you know, from day one, I shared that I would not take corporate PAC dollars, that I wouldn't take AIPAC money, simply because I think that the only thing that should be, that a representative should be focused on is representing their constituents, not trying to appease big money spends.
And could you talk a little bit about your own background and how that informed your vision and especially your firm stand against ICE and the immigration raids?
Look, like many Americans, I'm watching this chaos with disgust and horror. Like anyone who has studied American history understands, every time across our nation's history, we keep having these cycles of when regular everyday Americans grab those words of freedom and try to pull them to cover as many of us as possible. We have kind of a reaction in this nation, whether it was after Reconstruction or after the Civil Rights Movement or after the election of Barack Obama, it's almost as if we have this snapback, this clapback to expansive freedom. So after Reconstruction, you have Jim Crow, where the capture of Supreme Courts, state-sanctioned violence, where political machinations to limit people's voting rights ends up ushering in 100 years of oppression towards the Black community. You see the same thing after the Civil Rights Movement. It's almost as if the war on drugs was a response to that seeking of expansive power or expansive democracy. And I contend that after the election of Barack Obama across this country, you had forces who were very angry at the idea of a just and free United States. It feels like we are caught in this cycle, but the thing that breaks it is organizing. It's having community speaking with each other. It is training each other, engaging each other, understanding our history so that we can protect our democratic institutions and we could preserve the kind of self-governance that we strive for in the United States. I think we are at a critical moment in our country, and it requires sending organizers across the country, including Congress.
We want to thank you so much, Ana Lilia Mejia, for joining us, Democratic nominee for New Jersey's 11th Congressional District. That does it for our show on Monday, February 23rd. We will be celebrating our 30th anniversary, Democracy Now!, at Riverside Church in New York. Juan will be flying in from Chicago. Nermeen Sheikh will be here. I'll be joining with Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, Masaba Butoha, V, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and more. See democracynow.org for details. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Are you an artist, band, or record label? We want you to send us your music so we can put it on the radio. Not only this station, but stations across Canada. Check out earshot-distro.ca and share your music with more than 100 radio stations and programmers across the country. Earshot Distro is made by and for the campus community radio sector to help emerging musicians. Uploads cost $7 per song or $50 per album. Learn more at earshot-distro.ca.
Radio Rewind.